Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen unexpectedly fall for each other in Long Shot, while Dennis Quaid gets his meme face on for The Intruder.
But we're going to start with Jonathan Levine's The Long Shot, although I guess more appropriately, this really is Seth Rogen's and Charlize Theron's film. Basically centers around Charlize Theron's character, who is Secretary of State for this buffoon TV president. Not too on the nose there, but he chooses to endorse her for president of the United States in 2020. But somehow, yada yada yada, she ends up running into Seth Rogen, who is a kid that she used to babysit when she was a 16-year-old. And you know, she was that plucky liberal who was in your school and running for class president and idealistic and all this fun stuff. And you know, she made a career out of it. Good for her. So this movie, right off the bat, this movie is hysterical. I'm not really like a huge laugh out loud person at movies. I just have like a very specific sense of humor that is not necessarily catered to in mainstream film. So to that end, I was actually just, overjoyed at a lot of the one-liners in this film. There's just as a quick for instance, and I want to specify the humor here because I think that is by far the strongest part of this film. There's one scene where they travel to Sweden and Seth Rogen is dressed up in traditional Swedish garb and he just has like a one-hand... an offhanded liner saying I look like Captain Crunch's grinder date or something like that. It's these funny Seth Rogen-isms that, he's honed down to a science at this point. Charlize Theron is absolutely hilarious. You know, there's a scene where they do ecstasy, which, you've seen it in the trailer. But the way that that plays out and plays into the film on a broader scale and plays into the main story is really, really funny. And she just sells it so well. And if she's never done the drug, she could have fooled me. I'll just say that. As a political comedy, I don't think it, it's pretty lightweight stuff, and I don't think there's anything in this movie that anyone on either side of the spectrum will find too disagreeable, so don't go in expecting to find heavy-hitting politics. At its heart, it's really a romantic comedy, and I think the chemistry between Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron, attractiveness disparity aside, I think they have great chemistry. They're really entertaining to watch together, and you genuinely believe them as they kind of fall in love with each other. And it's there are callbacks to playing into the ideas of all these 80s and 90s pop culture cliches, specifically surrounding romantic comedies. Like there's one scene where they dance to Roxette's "It Must Have Been Love." There's good stuff in here. It's really entertaining, and sometimes you need to go and just shut your brain off and enjoy it honestly. I knew I was in good hands in the opening scene, that we kind of get some dialogue over the opening credits before we ever get to see anything. And the way that scene plays out is very, very funny. And again, it's one of those things where unless you're of a very specific subset, I don't think you're going to find anything too disagreeable about what this movie has to say on the political spectrum. I am probably further left than this movie's politics are presented, but that's, what the hell. I enjoyed it anyway.
Yeah, I thought it was really good. Much like you, I don't pretend to be, the biggest rom-com fan, but this is definitely one of my favorites in recent memory, and I think it really does come down to the two leads, as you alluded to. I was, ragging my brain as you were talking. I was thinking about, when's the last time Charlize Theron was bad in anything? I couldn't think of it, and I'm sure people would be like, oh, this or that, but I can't think of anything, and I think she's really great here, and I think her and Seth Rogen have just really good chemistry, not just on screen, but, I am one of these film people who, like, in the build-up to a movie, I'll watch, random interviews on, YouTube, and they have really good chemistry off-screen, so you could see that transfer on-screen really well. Like you alluded to, it's sort of taking on some of the typical tropes of the rom-com, sort of, putting Charlize Theron in the role that would typically, in the past be reserved for the male, a figure in power, and then sort of Seth Rogen in the more, throwback, female lead, and I thought it really worked really well, and I thought their chemistry... What I liked about it was that it wasn't just, the humor to it, but there was just simple moments where you really felt a connection between the two, which really helped. And obviously, they sort of have the flashback to him, as a kid, and her babysitting him. And I thought that was a nice touch without going too far, and having to, over-explain crazy things. You alluded to the Molly sequence. That was definitely my favorite sequence of the film. I thought, just the dynamic, obviously, with Rogen, being very, very drug-heavy. What a shock. Charlize Theron not. I even love that scene where I forget, but they're at some event and Seth Rogen is like at the, they're like through the metal detector and they're checking, and Seth Rogen's just like putting out all his drugs. Like, oh, you're not a real cop, right? I'm good, right? I thought that was a really nice touch. And they're just utilizing the actors sort of, you know, typically how they viewed and sort of using that to comedic effect, as most, I feel like, Seth Rogen's projects do. I also want to give a shout out to another member of the cast. And it's not exactly a shock, because this guy has been blowing up big time over the last few years. And that is Ice Cube Jr. himself, O'Shea Jackson Jr. And I think he's really great. There's just really a great scene that I really love at the end, you know, between him and Rogan. I think that, you know, what I love about this is sort of O'Shea Jackson is filling that other typical rom-com role of the best friend. Typically, it's to the female lead. Obviously, in this case, it's to Seth Rogan. And I loved that send-up of it, where it's just, it's not presented in, oh, look what we're doing. It's presented very natural, and he's just serving that role. And I thought it works really well. It's like, oh, what are you doing? You gotta pursue her and stuff like this. I thought that was really clever, and I think they also sort of bring about a really positive message sort of towards the end with him, with his interactions. But just overall, I just thought it was really enjoyable to watch. There's nothing that like jumps out as like, oh, too, you know, like you alluding to one side or the other. In fact, you know, I have a lot of respect for the movie. In fact, you know, there's clearly, you don't have to look very far for those of you who are tapped in to see some of the veiled takes on certain news programs and ridiculous beliefs spouted in current culture. But what I love about it is, you know, it's fun and done in not an obnoxious way. Take note, Adam McKay. You know, obviously this is a much different film than what Adam McKay was going for, but I feel like, you know, in this film, like you alluded to, it's just more of a light comedy that's meant to be enjoyable, but I actually do think it has some pretty positive messaging and things that maybe subliminally people will pick up on and maybe understand a bit better about culture and just sort of the view of women in general. I think that was something that I think the film really took on, but in a great way. It wasn't done in like a completely obnoxious, heavy-handed way. It was done with comedy in tow, so I thought it really worked, and the message sort of came across through that. But, you know, Jonathan Levine is sort of, you know, he made, you know, 50-50 with Seth Rogen and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He sort of branched into these sort of mainstream sort of comedy dramedies, I guess you could say, sort of better, and I think he does acquits himself well here. And, you know, like Ryan and I have talked about, you know, rom-coms aren't exactly our thing, but I think this is definitely one of the more enjoyable, definitely in recent years, and probably one of my favorites of the genre in general.
Oh, totally, and I will say this is probably the most I've laughed out loud at a movie, and I know this is not the same thing, but Sorry to Bother You was what I thought was the funniest movie of last year. So far, this is the funniest movie I've seen this year, and I mean, this is, you know, obviously not going for the same thing, but, you know, different styles of comedy, and somehow it works for me with a very singular taste. Jonathan Levine, I think his biggest strength, I mean, because there's really nothing super interesting about him as a filmmaker per se, but I think what his biggest strength is that he knows how to utilize each member of the cast to their strengths. Some of the cameos that show up in this film, like Lisa Kudrow, is kind of like a, I guess, someone who's doing a focus group for Charlize Theron and just showing, going over all the categories in which she is graded as a politician. Paul Shearer is kind of like a Brian Kilmeade surrogate in this, which is just absolutely hysterical and has a great payoff at the end. And I want to give a shout out to Alexander Skarsgård as the Prime Minister of Canada. Oh my God, this man has just such untapped comedic potential. Why the hell is no one realizing this? It's just, and you know, it, again, it's all, it's softball stuff. It's not meant to be taken like super heavy, this is a straight comedy. There is no drama whatsoever within this film. But it's just that, you know, he knows how to kind of, Jonathan Levine knows how to send up the current climate, and I think he does it in a really subtle way that's not overbearing or super preachy, and I think that the actors know how to play into that, and, you know, it just has a great payoff with, Alexander Skarsgård's Prime Minister character. I don't even know if it's supposed to be a Trudeau per se, but it's just like one of those, you know, it's a weird Canadian dude. What else can you say? It's, you know, the talking about how people didn't find his laugh sexy enough or something like that. And it just has a great payoff. And the way he just like has these like awkward mannerisms, it's really, it's something that really, really struck me because it's an injection of weirdness in an otherwise broad comedy. And not that I'm saying the broad comedy was bad. I think broad comedy can be hysterical. And in this case, it absolutely was. And, you know, Charlize Theron just completely owns this movie. You're right. She hasn't been bad in anything, probably ever. Just every single thing. True professional. She goes for it, and she gives it 110% in everything. And, you know, good for her for standing out, for not wanting to play Wonder Woman's mom. She's only fucking 10 years older than Gal Gadot.
Amen to that. But, yeah, just, I guess, some last sort of general thoughts. I mean, you were mentioning some of the cameos that popped up. I want to give special accommodation to Diane Raphael, who plays sort of, Charlize Theron's right-hand woman, and I loved the dynamic between her and Seth Rogen in particular. I thought they really mined comedy really well outside of that. I thought she was perfect, you know, for that role in particular. And I thought, I don't know, just some of the back and forth between her and Rogen, some of the party sequences, I thought that worked really well. And they sort of upend some of the expectations with her as well as the story goes along. But just, I guess, to put a cap on this movie, you know, obviously both of us, you know, really enjoyed it. And I think it definitely gets a recommendation from both of us. But now I'm going to transition into The Intruder, a movie which, safe to say, you know, I mean, we've been sort of racking our brains, and some of these weeks, even though it's the summer, it's weird sort of pairing different movies with other things. And, you know, we decided to pair The Intruder because there wasn't really much else that was accessible, you know, to us. And safe to say, this, you know, isn't typical fare we dive into. This is directed by Dion Taylor, a filmmaker who in recent years has sort of made, you know, I was reading some article that said he's basically a one-man Blumhouse, where he's making all these very low-budget thrillers for particularly an urban audience. And he's, you know, just making them on the cheap, and they're sort of utilizing a lot of cliches of previous genres. And safe to say, The Intruder is definitely that. If you've seen the trailer, you know exactly what the movie is. Essentially, we have this couple played by Michael Ealy and Megan Good, who essentially they're looking. Megan Good has always wanted this, you know, big house in Napa Valley, and Michael Ealy is working at this high-end job. And now, you know, he's made enough money that they have the opportunity to go out and, you know, find, you know, the perfect home. And so they visit this picturesque. I will give the movie credit for one thing. It has a great setting. It's just this really great, you know, house, you know, in the woods set in Napa Valley, but it has some really interesting visuals and dynamics to it. But essentially, you know, they show up, and Dennis Quaid, of course, is the owner of the house, and there's some secret history to Dennis Quaid that is revealed as the movie goes along. But essentially, this is a typical stalker movie, where Dennis Quaid agrees to sell them the house, and then he's showing up. They show this in the trailer where he's still mowing the lawn, you know, as they, but safe to say it goes to extremes after that. But really, you know, I will say this movie is not good. It's basically every cliche in the book, but because, you know, I'm not used to watching this thing, and I haven't watched a movie like this in like 2 decades, I will say it was much more enjoyable than I expected, because it was like, while these are cliches that have been done to death over and over again, I haven't seen them in a while. So getting to see them again and seeing Dennis Quaid just do his thing, as I allude to in the intro, becoming a complete meme. His face is like, you know, people have alluded to, you know, Dennis Quaid's rubbery face here. Like, there's certain moments, and, you know, I will say, you know, I wanted to see this, and obviously, you know, from some of my comments in previous episodes, I really wanted to see a Dennis Quaid project, because, like I said, I think in the last episode, when are we ever going to get the chance again? Because it's not like exactly his career is firing, you know, on all cylinders, but I have a connection to Dennis Quaid growing up. I think I watched The Frequency a million times or something, you know, growing up, and so I just wanted to see him in a modern context. And safe to say, it's not the greatest performance, but he's clearly having fun embracing his inner villain. You know, like I said, so your mileage may vary on some of the facial expressions, because some of them work, and then some of them are like so ridiculous, or like so out of the realm of normality, that it's hard to even know what to think or say about it. But I will give the movie credit for setting up a few elements within the house that do pay off later on that I wasn't necessarily expecting. At least it had some ambition to it, as opposed to just, you know, this straight thriller. But, you know, the truth is, you know, this thing is either your thing or it isn't. You know, it's not necessarily my thing, but I think because I haven't seen many movies of this genre in recent years that I was able to enjoy it. You know, Michael Ealy and Megan Good, they do their best. Essentially, you know, Dennis Quaid essentially becomes, you know, really close to the Megan Good character, and Michael Ealy, of course, in the typical cliche way, is, you know, very, you know, against it. But of course, he's proven right in the end, as is typical of all of these type of genre thrillers. But, you know, like I said, you know, it's not good. It's cliche filled, you know, but you could do a lot worse if you're just looking for a real, like, crazy throwback, and you just want to see, you know, Dennis Quaid just get his meme on and make many ridiculous faces over and over again. Although I do have to criticize one particular element. Like I said, this isn't good, but there's one element in particular of the film that I found really obnoxious, and that's the soundtrack. They do try to utilize some rap and hip-hop songs. Obviously, with this film and a lot of the films of the director, Deion Taylor, being primarily aimed, you know, at a black audience. So it makes sense, obviously, connecting it on that level. But it's done to such an obnoxious degree that it's, like, almost, like, irritating at times. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the score, which at times, as you can expect from a thriller of this type, of course it's going to be over the top and take on things in that way. But some of the song choices, like, the way the movie starts and the way it ends and cuts the credits, it's just, like, the music is so loud and so obnoxious and doesn't feel to fit the tone of the movie at all that it was just... It was just quite baffling, and I think the rest of the older audience are watching with me, I think, felt similarly on that level. But, you know, credit to Deion Taylor for continuing his career and making these really low-budget films and making a successful career out of it. These movies are clearly, you know, for a specific audience, you know, not necessarily for me in any way. But I will say I enjoyed it against all odds, but it's not a good movie in any way.
I unfortunately was not able to get to The Intruder. Quick story time. In 2008, when I first saw Hellboy 2 in theaters, they had the film reel in backwards. So the trailer reel was literally playing in reverse for the first, I'd say, 5 minutes. That's a quick fix, but in this age of digital, if the projector breaks, the projector breaks. The projector broke, and I got to use my Fandango credit so I could watch the long shot this morning. But instead, I watched, and I'm sorry, I have to look at my phone really quick because this is such a convoluted title. Thank you, Netflix, by the way, for courting all this great talent and kind of classing up the direct-to-video class. So I watched Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile, which is directed by Joe Berenger and centers around the infamous serial killer slash media circus, Ted Bundy. And I even hate saying the guy's name out loud because, you know, as the title implies, those words, it is a convoluted title, but this is actually something that was spoken by the judge at the trial, which, funnily enough, was actually the first capital murder trial ever tried on television. I will get into the wisdom of the reality of the situation in a little bit, because I want to touch on the movie, because this is a movie podcast, but I do want to get into the reality of it and involve Andrew, because Andrew has not hasn't seen the movie yet, but I do have a couple questions for him that appeal to more like the serial killer thriller genre at large. So I will say, this is a tale of two movies. The first half is god-awful, terrible, boring, it doesn't go anywhere, sequences drag on way too long. It's basically Zac Efron, who is very, very good. The entire cast is quite good, but Zac Efron, I mean, this is a guy who is very underrated. We've seen him in great, you know, give great work before. My favorite performance was probably in Richard Linklater's Me and Orson Welles. But here, I think he really just, like, kind of embodies that, you know, that fake psychopathic charisma that Ted Bundy had, and that he was able to trick so many people. The film, and I'll give it, I don't want to, like, kind of poo-poo the first, because it just has, like, that cheesy, crappy dialogue that you'd expect from a movie, TV movie of the week. And it is able to overcome that in the second half when we get to the courtroom stuff. The biggest compliment I can give the film is that there is actually very little on-screen violence here. It doesn't glorify anything of that he did, which I think is a trapping that a lot of these serial killer movies fall into, and I think just kind of misses the forest from the trees. But this movie is very much focused on the fact that this man had nothing but superficial charms. It's under the DSM-5, is one of the under the diagnoses of a psychopath, that is one of the number one symptoms of it. So I think that they're leaning into this, and I think Berenger's, for those of you who don't know, he is a documentary filmmaker first and foremost, primarily the Paradise Lost films, which I think are fantastic, and Jesus, I haven't seen those in forever. But if you haven't seen those, if you're in the mood to feel really depressed, go out and seek those out. But if you're a little less adventurous but still want to be depressed, you can't necessarily go wrong with this particular film. Once we get, you know, kind of the halfway point and Bundy has been arrested, you know, it kind of goes back and forth. The editing is horrendous. It goes back and forth between, you know, Bundy's life behind bars and trying to prove his quote unquote innocence, while his wife, played aptly by Lily Collins, is just trying to move on from the fact that she ended up marrying this monster, you know, not even human. I mean, Ted Bundy is I hope he's an anomaly on this planet. I know there are probably plenty of people who are fantasizing about something some of the things that Ted Bundy actually carried out, and I want to say thank you very much for having some form of self-restraint. But I think the film is at its best in the second half when, you know, John Malkovich plays the judge who presides over the trial, and he just has, like, this, like, kind of a smarmy Floridian charm that charm isn't the right word, but swagger, I guess, is more accurate. Jim Parsons is the state prosecutor, and just, like, kind of the repartee between them and Zac Efron, and watching Zac Efron embody this very charismatic individual who knew how to manipulate media, manipulate the system. This is just watching the three of them kind of go at it is very, very entertaining. And then, unfortunately, they show a lot of the real-life courtroom stuff at the end, so entertaining kind of turns into darkness by the end of it. But the film is at its best when it's kind of, and it doesn't do it enough, unfortunately. There is a lot on its plate, but when it's critiquing, it was an open court. It was the first film ever, the first capital murder case ever put on trial on television. So I want to question the wisdom of the United States of America for thinking that that's even remotely a good idea. And they were showing real life clips of all these women who were showing up to support Ted Bundy because, oh my God, he's just so dreamy and everything like that. And, you know, that's the problem with it. And I think that's part of the fascination that America has with serial killers. I don't have as strong a stomach, and, you know, I work in social services, so I've dealt a lot with mental health, so I have no fucking tolerance whatsoever for this kind of shit. And, you know, just seeing these people kind of fawn over him, this isn't a fucking TV show. This guy killed at least 30 people that we know of, and it's estimated that it was even more. So shame on anyone who thinks that this is some form of, like, entertainment, or that it's, you know, he's a dreamboat or someone who deserves any amount of support whatsoever. It is just an ungodly human being, and I use the word human being very sparingly, because it's just gross. And I think Berenger should be commended for touching on that and restraining on the violence, but still getting across just how evil a guy he actually was. So I kind of want to turn it over to you. The film overall, it hits it where it counts. The courtroom stuff, while it's not an in-depth courtroom drama, they hit the emotional beats of it incredibly well, and it really makes up for the first half. And James Hetfield, the lead singer of Metallica, is in it, and he plays a cop, and it's a bad makeup job, and he sucks. I just want to throw that in there. But I want to open it up to you a little bit, because I know you're a big fan of this subgenre. I question the wisdom, and you know this is coming from the heart. I question the wisdom sometimes of telling these types of stories, because, you know, a lot of this, you know, let's just say Natural Born Killers, which was supposed to be a satire of this type of thing, a more direct satire, actually inspired some real-life killings. So where is the line, and is it, where is the wisdom necessarily in portraying these kinds of stories? I know that's a very loaded question, and these films are making great points, but the fact that Zac Efron had to go on TV because after the trailer was released and all these teenage girls were like, oh man, I don't get it, why is he so cute and funny and hot and everything? And Zac Efron's like, you people are fucking idiots. You don't understand. That's the point of the whole movie. Where is there a line, or is it just that most people aren't necessarily, let's just put it this way, they're missing the forest for the trees, per se?
Well, you asked the wrong person as far as whether there's a line, because, you know, I'm someone who makes no bones about it, and I've talked about previously, you know, when I've talked about, you know, Lars von Trier on here and stuff, you know, I'm someone who craves, you know, new experiences, who pushes me to feelings, even if I don't want to emotionally feel these feelings, I'm willing to go to certain lengths, you know. Obviously, I think there's a lot of wisdom in what you say, you know, but I feel like it really comes down to a lack of education, lack of people, you know, in society really understanding, you know, these things and elements. You know, I think a lot of society in general nowadays can come down to that. This, you know, not having the perspective on these things, or not just not having the knowledge of these horrible acts that people have committed. And obviously there's always been, you know, a fine line when you think about it, just in terms of, you know, the news landscape. You think about, you know, the way people, you know, talk about, oh, should these incredibly violent acts be covered, or should they not be? You know, it's really, you know, it's a really tough, you know, it's something that's, it's a really nuanced, you know, argument to be made, you know, whether, wherever you come down on it. You have to, you know, really think about it, and it's like, you have to report the news, because otherwise, you know, we're not living, you know, in reality, whereas the other hand, there are always going to be people who take these events and, you know, try to glorify them in some way, or overlook the clear, you know, terrible nature, you know, of these things. So I feel like there's always going to be people, you know, in society who take it the wrong way, who don't understand and don't have the ability to understand due to, you know, I would say, you know, a lack of education, you know. So, you know, for me, it's like, you know, I love, you know, anything that discusses, you know, the serial killer genre. You mentioned, you know, know, Joe Berlinger's previous, you know, Paradise Lost trilogy, which are some of my absolute favorite films. I think I went through a phase. It was actually, I just saw them like a few years back, where I went through a phase and watched them, and I just became obsessed, you know. And, you know, I'm a big fan, you know, just in more of the fictional realm, you know, I'm a big fan of films like Zodiac, you know, so many others, you know, that I really connect to on that level. And it really is a tricky thing, you know, for a filmmaker like Joe Berlinger to create sort of, you know, that dynamic, you know, and to really make sure it comes across in the right way, as opposed to, you know, people taking it. But I feel like sometimes it really is out of the filmmakers and actors' hands, and sometimes people are just going to take it any way they want to, regardless, you know, of the intention of the filmmaker. And that could lead to a whole other debate, you know, as I certainly get a lot of thoughts on, you know, people, you know, filmmakers being like, oh, this is the intention. As far as I'm concerned, whatever, you know, an audience takes from it, you know, is, you know, their experience with it. So obviously it can get tricky there, you know, with an audience who might not be on the up and up or really understand the dynamics of these things. You know, but for me, like I said, I might not be the right person, you know, to really have the definitive comment on that, because these are the type of things I live for. I love seeing, you know, the horrible stuff, because, you know, obviously I know that this is, you know, obviously they're taking on real events and presenting them on screen in a distinct way. And I feel like there's some real drama and tension there. I think a lot of it comes from me being a horror guy, you know, and really liking that dark, you know, material. But obviously there's a difference between me enjoying, you know, enjoying a movie about these subjects and then, you know, obviously, you know, some people out there, you know, glorifying these terrible, you know, people. And that's the thing that, you know, I feel like is prevalent in a lot of society nowadays, whereas a lot of people will just sort of push aside or overlook the truth for entertainment purposes. And I guess that's sort of, you know, it's tough. Like, I guess I'm not really making, you know, a definitive statement one way or the other than just it's a really tough situation, you know, to be in general.
It is. And, you know, when I say I question the wisdom of it, it's, you know, obviously the Berlinger is making the point that the media is to blame. And absolutely, I have so many issues with American media that I could write a dissertation on it if I had any motivation to go to back to school. But that's neither here nor there. It's just something like, you know, we can critique what we're seeing, but we're also at the same time, I you know, this is going to fall on deaf ears. Like you said, people are just going to interpret it the way they want to. But I also like part of me is feeling, and again, I don't think there was a right answer, but part of me also feels that why is it even worth telling these stories in the first place if that's how people are going to interpret it? Why do we want to give such a story a platform? You know, we have I don't want to name names because we'll get demonetized, but certain individuals who were recently banned from Facebook, one of whom is now in millions of dollars worth of debt, and frankly, he fucking deserves it. But that kind of deplatforming, taking away the voice, taking away that story, can work. And I just, you know, there is a fascination. I think, you know, how can a seemingly, you know, on the surface normal individual do that? It's a mental health issue, and I don't want to, you know, kind of reduce it down or sound like I'm being reductive, but the psychopathy is a mental illness, period. And I don't want to say that, you know, better mental health care will completely cure all this shit, but at the end of the day, it is a mental health story. This is not like and it is a story about how the media can kind of misinterpret a mental illness and just kind of run with it in the opposite direction, and it creates this vicious cycle of other people who might be feeling lost and lonely seeing someone finally getting attention, and then to just, you know, wanting that little bit of infamy, even if it's, you know, the opposite of a pat on the back. I mean, it's, you know, I'm twisting myself in pretzels even trying to think about this. There is no easy answer, but at least, and I love Zodiac. Zodiac is one of the best movies of the aughts. But I think that film is very careful in how it depicts violence as well. I just don't know, man. It's a tough, tough call. And I just really wish that if our news media was better about covering this kind of shit and not giving voices to those idiots who are, you know, and even like people at the fucking, this stuck out to me, the Casey Anthony trial, the woman from like 5-6 years ago who was accused of killing her daughter. There were people who were like lining up so they could get a spot in court. And I remember very distinctly one woman saying, oh, this is better. This is TV for me. This is better. Like, these are people's lives. This is not something that should be open to the public. These should be closed courts and tried by actual professionals. No fucking cameras in the courtroom, period. And maybe someday we wouldn't even necessarily have to have a conversation like this.
Yeah, amen to that. You know, I don't even know what else to say other than, you know, I mean, you're spot on. And it's just sort of, you know, it just people just need to, you know, expand. I feel like so many people in society nowadays just have a very narrow view of things in general, regardless of what your belief system is. And it really just comes down to, you know, educating yourself, expanding your mind, and understanding these different perspectives. You know, obviously, we're both film guys and film enthusiasts. And that's why I crave, you know, like I said, I crave these new experiences. I just want something that is going to push me to my emotional breaking point or limits. But there's a lot of people who don't experience film in that way or experience it more on just the simple entertainment level. And I think that's where we get into some of the tricky nature of it. But yeah, I mean, I'm definitely intrigued to check out the movie. I don't know how soon I will, you know, just because, you know, I got quite the lineup for the summer. But, you know, I'm always, it's definitely subject matter that I'm always interested in, you know, but, you know, I just think that there's always going to be sections of society that just take it in a way that it wasn't intended or just completely blowing it out of proportion to such a degree and just not understanding the actual situation. But I was struck, as we were talking through this film, I was looking through Joe Berlinger's IMDb page, and I was struck that, you know, he's primarily made, you know, mostly documentaries. In fact, this is only his second narrative feature outside of a documentary, and I just wanted to mention this. This is sort of getting back to the film and not sort of so serious, but I was struck by his previous narrative feature that he directed, the incredibly, absolutely god-awful Book of Shadows, which is the infamous Blair Witch sequel from back in the day, which I remember, like, when I was going through a phase a few years ago, you know, just like I said, every Halloween I try and, you know, catch up on, you know, the movies of the genre that I haven't seen, and a few years back I did get around to watching Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2, and honestly, I'm someone who always, you know, watches movies in full regardless of how bad it is, but I will say I was very tempted to stop it at a certain point, because it was just bringing, it really brought absolutely nothing to the table, which I just think it, you know, I mean, and obviously I haven't seen this new film, so I can't comment on that, but I just think it speaks to something, I don't know, just sort of bring it back around, I just think it speaks to something where Joe Berlinger made these absolute instant classic documentaries about the West Memphis Three that are absolutely unbelievable, and Ryan is right, you should absolutely check out all these Paradise Lost films, you know, if you can stomach it, because it's definitely, you know, well worth it if you're into these things, you know, like I am, but I think some filmmakers, you know, just work better in one medium than another, and I can't comment on this recent film, but I don't know, that was just something that I was struck by and I just wanted to mention or comment on.
Yeah, that's I was wondering what that look on your face was when I was talking. That makes total sense now. But enough of all this dour shit. Next week we got Pokemon. Hey, how about that? We will be tackling Detective Pikachu, something very low stakes and fun and goofy and bright and Jesus fucking Christ, I need that after that. We'll also be tackling John Wick 3, and I have a promise for you, Andrew. I swear to God I'm going to watch 1 and 2 this week. I swear. My wife is as to work at night a couple nights this week. I'm just going to go. She doesn't have to watch the puppy get punched in the face. I will suffer through it for her.
Good God. All I have to say is I could not be more... Honestly, this is honestly one of the most pumped movies I am pumped for, especially after the recent critical reception. A lot of people are saying it's the best John Wick film. For those of you who haven't diving into the John Wick films, you know, if, you know, the best action sequences of all time are your thing, then you should definitely watch these movies. For those of you that don't know some of the backstory, these films are actually made by Keanu Reeves' former stunt double. You know, so this is where this connection sort of came from, and they've been able to make these, you know, just incredible action sequences, and man, does it show. Like, these are films, you know, I know a lot of people, you know, view Keanu, and he is that sort of very typical, you know, he's in that sort of typical, you know, Keanu role, but I think what these films have above all others is they literally have some of the best action sequences in cinematic history, and it also has some really intriguing world building the more the series goes along, so definitely look out for that, particularly as it moves into chapter 2. But I couldn't be more pumped for chapter 3, and I know just based on the reception that we're gonna see some of the most insane action sequences of all time, and I am absolutely here for it.
And, you know, I was going through the IMDb cast list of this film, and anything that has the host of Iron Chef America and the backup center for the Philadelphia 76ers, that's going to be all right in my book. But as always, thank you so much for listening to us, and we will see you next week.